Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. I'm Dawn Davenport, your host and the director of Creating a Family. Today, we're going to be talking about coping with the stress of infertility with Dr. Tanya Wood. She is a clinical psychologist specializing in family planning, pregnancy loss, and infertility. She is the director of clinical training at Pepperdine University and is the 2020 president of the California Psychological Association. Welcome, Dr. Wood, to Creating a Family. Thank you so much for talking with us today about a really important topic for both nurses and patients and doctors alike, and that is the coping with the stress of infertility. Infertility is, as it almost seems like such an obvious statement to say, it is a stressful disease, but it really, really is. I have been working in this field since, 2007, and you much longer, I am sure. And it is such a hard disease to have. Why do you think it is that infertility, in all of its many ramifications, which would include miscarriage, why is it such a hard disease for people to cope with?
And thank you so much, Dawn, for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you. And yes, you're right. It is very stressful. And why is it so stressful? I think is there's so many factors and complexities to the diagnosis, right? And you said the word disease. And I think, you know, for certain diseases that individuals have that are known and talked about and familiar, and there's kind of a social space created for the emotions and grieving process and losses that come mm-hmm. along with it. That doesn't mean it's less stressful, but I think there's something known about that, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think with infertility, it's unexpected. You know, it comes up against the narrative that we've lived with our whole lives about this process of partnering or parenting or whatever future lives will be like. So it's unexpected. It doesn't fit this sort of idea in our head of what our futures will be like. There's a lot of unknown and uncertainties mm-hmm. about it, you know, that you know, roller coaster of emotions of like finding out, discovering things about yourself that you didn't know were not there. And I think this sort of sense of inability to kind of affect the outcome, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We think we know what to do to conceive and to get pregnant. And then it's like, oh, but this and then this, and there's another situation added on. And I think it's part sort of psychologically, it's all of those things, but then there's also all the other areas of our lives it affects. It's financially stressful. It's expensive.
Yeah.
So there's the expense. There's a lot of time involved. It's very time intensive. Mm-hmm. And it begins to kind of just, you know, take over all parts of our lives. So I think it's, I know that's a very long answer, but that I think is why it is so stressful. It's unknown and all consuming.
I couldn't agree with you more. And one thing just to add about the expense, oftentimes for many people, insurance doesn't cover it. So as unlike other diseases, in addition to knowing that you have a disease that is robbing you of something that is very important in your life, you also then may not have the savings to cover the treatment or are expected
exactly.
to cover the treatment. So
exactly.
a double whammy. Let's talk about some of the various losses that, and I'm going to separate men and women just so we could explore how men and women, the losses may be the same or may be different. So let's talk about some of the, I think one of the other things that's hard about infertility, it's not just one loss. It's the loss of so many things that are associated with the disease of infertility. I mean, the obvious one is the inability to easily conceive, you know, that the image of how your life was going to plan out a dramatic mm-hmm. alteration of the, you know, when you were skipping rope as a little girl and, you know, first comes love, next comes marriage, then comes, right. you know, so with the baby carriage, you know, that, and we spent years trying not to conceive and then
exactly.
And then a little irritated by the time that we spent not trying to conceive. And then so certainly not being able to parent is one of them, or not being able to conceive, but it's also just a major change in your plans,
right.
if
right.
nothing else. So what are some of the other losses that are associated with the diagnosis of infertility?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and this is, I think, a great part of the conversation, especially talking about like some of those stresses, because you're right that maybe idea of parenthood, but related to that are other sort of areas of identity, right? And you asked about differences in men and women, and I can get to some of that, but I think speaking specifically to women, that sense of identity as a woman, you know, it's almost like, you know, like you said, part of that narrative is like, it's a given right, maybe specifically maybe for cisgendered women who are like, mm-hmm. you know, that's my natural, you know, mm-hmm. the one thing I have as a woman.
Yeah.
and that is
my identity of being a cisgendered woman.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is lost. I think social relationships, in some way, social connections, and whether that's because, you know, you're not so part of that group of people in your cohort who are having kids and now parenting. So you sort of lose that social relationship or way to yes. connect to others, or by social avoidance, because there are things we want to avoid.
Yeah. Know? But it's still a loss. It's a loss of yes. whether you're choosing it or the fact that you just don't have as much in common, or they're not
exactly.
available, or, you know,
exactly.
they don't want to go out late on a Friday night, that type
right.
of thing.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So there's a loss of like social relationships. And I think, and within our, you know, romantic relationships, there's a loss of privacy. You know,
yeah.
your doctors know all about what's going on in your sex life, and
yeah.
and there's a loss of intimacy there. And, you know, so I think those kinds of things are what is lost, in addition to some of the things that we've already talked about that come up unexpectedly. And I think mm-hmm. especially in the contrast, right, we go into this process with expectations and hopes and fantasies yeah. and notions, and then slowly those are all like chipped away and taken away mm-hmm. from us.
In some ways, yes. And so how are some of the ways that men might experience it different, both whether or not they are the one with the diagnosis of infertility mm-hmm. or whether their partner has a diagnosis?
Yeah. And, you know, in some ways you're right. I think it depends on who maybe has the diagnosis. And I think that for men, where is a male related reason, I think it's some of the same concepts and ideas I just mentioned in terms of identity and sense of manhood and, you know, those types of questions and ideas about themselves may come up. Mm-hmm. But I think also this idea about how to be a partner, you know, in either situation, I think that, you know, more than anything, and these I'm speaking somewhat in sort of gender role stereotypes, so please forgive me. Mm-hmm. But I think there's this, you know, idea of sort of protecting and nurturing and caring for your partner. And, you know, it's very common for me to hear in my practice of male partners just not knowing what to do mm-hmm. for their female partners, mm-hmm. You know, in this situation, because they're like, I can't physically actually do anything. I can't mm-hmm. offer to carry the child. I can't, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know what to say when this person is upset and distressed. I don't know how to make them feel better. Mm-hmm. So I think they feel a sense of a loss of that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so in the same vein, sort of sense of identity, and I think this idea of legacy too. You know, I don't think we talk mm-hmm. about that much, but you know, this idea of leaving behind, you know, mm-hmm. namesakes or my genetic material, and I mm-hmm. think that is present also for men
and women as well. But I agree with you, and I also agree that we don't talk about it. It's almost like we're not supposed to. That, you know, that seems so antiquated,
yeah.
but that. That ability to pass on the not just the family name, but pass on the family genes,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
pass on your grandfather's huge ears or whatever,
yeah.
you know, the,
yeah, yeah.
yeah the, yes, I think there is something. Why, we certainly hear in the creating a family community that guilt and shame are emotions that seem at first glance surprising. And yet we hear that for both women and men, if they are feeling open enough to talk about it, guilt and shame are present there too.
Mm-hmm.
Where
mm-hmm.
I'm asking if you see that, and also where does it come from?
Yeah. So I do see it. And my own sort of postulation as to where it comes from is feeling that we have done, I'll talk about this in sort of first person, as someone who's been through the infertility process myself, that we did something to create or cause this, right? That either from our patterns or lifestyle choices or behaviors in our youth, or, you know, that we did something that either created or caused this, or we could have prevented it. You know, we waited too long to get married. We waited too long to start having kids. I should have known more about my body. So I think that's where some of the guilt, and I think the shame, is just, again, that sort of contrast to sort of social norms and socialization about, you know, what you are supposed to be doing and should be doing. And then if you are not, I think we're getting a lot better with the stigma around this, but this idea of, like, you know, barrenness carries so much heaviness and weight to it that I think still permeates a little bit in society. And this idea of, you know, blaming the individuals who find themselves in these situations. And I think that's where it comes from.
And the frustrating thing is, even if you don't buy into it, into the norms that what you should be doing, you're still subject to the expectations of society. And a lot of people don't feel open to disclose that they have been trying. So the assumption when they talk with people is that, why are you still waiting? You know, you're not getting any younger. That throws shame your way. And then you either have to violate your sense of privacy to tell people, or you just have to suck it up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's true for single individuals as well. You know, the shame of, like, what did I do to find myself in a situation where I don't even have a partner to do the process, or I'm making this decision alone. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not something you agree with, it's hard to avoid the social judgment of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, something you alluded to at the beginning is a term that we've talked about here before, and that is ambiguous loss. That is, at infertility, we do not have the rituals surrounding the losses of infertility, and I will throw miscarriage in as well, that the losses through loss of a pregnancy. We don't have, as a society, the norms, the cultural norms for supporting that loss. Let's talk a little about what ambiguous loss means and how it adds to the complexity of dealing with a disease such as infertility.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this idea of ambiguous loss is that these sort of, as you mentioned, losses, whether physical or psychological experiences that we have that are not as concrete or identifiable as other losses, such as a death of a loved one, where there is a funeral, there's a death certificate, there's some marker that indicates that. But in ambiguous loss, those markers are not present. And so there's nothing sort of concrete or identifiable to characterize it as a loss. So there's a sort of lack of closure to that experience and process. And it's not seen or recognized or, you know, sort of legitimized by society because of the absence of those rituals or markers around the loss.
Even having a disease like cancer has its own forms of rituals, and people know how to respond. And there's not as much shame associated with it.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, the other part is that people don't, because we don't talk about it, you know, we don't talk about some of our experiences, like a miscarriage, for example, right? So it's an sort of added layer of something that maybe an individual or couple, they're already kind of holding in privately, but then also because of the absence of those rituals and markers or ways to recognize it socially or absent, it's a sort of a double whammy of sorts. And so the ambiguous loss sort of, it's unresolved, and it kind of is prolonged and, you know, sort of interferes with the ability to grieve. Those things that happen to us, especially in the infertility process.
If it's not recognized as a loss, then do you have the right to be sorry? Do you have the right to suffer, to grieve?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think this is true also maybe of other sort of members of our community who their losses, if they're part of a marginalized group, so maybe someone from the LGBTQ community, whereas, like, well, you know, the idea of even wanting to have kids may be met with some sort of question or skepticism. Mm-hmm. So then the loss of parenthood or loss of a child maybe becomes even less validated, you know?
Because you don't have the right to have, you know, this. Exactly. You shouldn't be even expecting to have a child, that type
right.
of thing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly.
And it makes you feel even less part of the norm if you're LGBTQ plus and still are desiring a child. That so much of this is changing, but mm-hmm. especially in the transgender community, probably they're mm-hmm. they're experiencing it more now than the other other aspects of LGBTQ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's hard. So let's talk about the relationship stress that often accompanies infertility, marriages or partnerships in general. How does infertility play out in partnership, in marriages?
Yeah, you know, there's so many things there, right? I think that
so many, so many. Let us count the ways,
right? I'm going to start first with, I think sometimes partners are not on the same page about the childbearing process and even ideas about, you know, the measures or methods they would take.
Yes. Continue. Yes. How far to go, how much money to spend. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And so I think that is one of the first things that may be encountered in a relationship or partnership or marriage that comes up in terms of impact of infertility. So coming to some agreement about the childbearing process, and then strategies for managing the stress of it is another, I think, place where it comes up. And we talked about this a little bit already, but in terms of, you know, being some gender differences for, you know, heterosexual couples in terms of how stress is managed, and, you know, who is in the process. So again, for male partners or females who are like going to the doctors and getting shots and taking hormones and having mm-hmm. ultrasounds. And they're like, so I think there can seem to be this sort of unevenness in what to do. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of seesaw of like the stress and grieving. So it's like, well, if she's stressed, I can't show my stress. So yeah. How can mm-hmm. I be present for her?
Uh-huh.
Which then can have maybe the partner saying like,
he doesn't care.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about a miscommunication. You know, another aspect that I think we really don't talk about much is the impact of enjoyment of your sex life.
Yes.
Exactly. You know, it's when we've done surveys in our really large online community, it's hard to find, I won't say it's impossible, but it is hard to find anyone going through infertility who is enjoying sex. And, right. you know, and that's and that impacts relationships as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of those losses, right? In terms of connection.
Yeah.
Because the spontaneity of sex, I mean, it can still be there, but now there's so much about timing and the process that, and sometimes you're told not to have sex, right? Mm-hmm. If you're getting ready for, a retrieval or a cycle, or, there's some days that your doctors are all up in your business, so to speak.
Yeah. You know? Not so to speak. Pretty exactly. Yeah. 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 But sex has taken on the, I mean, as I have heard more than one woman say, why even do it? You know, if I'm not going to get pregnant, not that before they were associating, they may have had a robust, healthy, enjoyable sex life using birth control. So, I mean, so it's not necessarily a logical thing, but when you're desperate to get pregnant and and you want to obviously have sex to get pregnant, if that's not happening, then it's kind of a why bother.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a sort of loss of connection in that.
Yes.
Right. And a way of coming together outside of this process and just as two individuals who care for each other and love each other and want to be affectionate, but it's, somewhat lost in this process.
And you know, the disagreement we talked about at the beginning of, you know, how far, I call it the escalator, how far up the escalator do you want to go? Mm-hmm. And there's differences there too. And those don't necessarily fall along gender lines. It's sometimes a woman who's going through all the treatment is like, you know, I'm the one, I'm becoming the human pincushion. I'm tired of this. And for the man, he can't conceive of any other, pardon the pun, any other option for yeah. parenthood. And so there's a disagreement there, or the man feels helpless and doesn't, and becoming a parent is not that important right. to him, perhaps, right. Assuming it's a heterosexual couple. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, it was true. If it's okay to do even some personal disclosure and sharing, that was Please. True in my marriage. This is my second marriage. And so some of my infertility challenges showed up in my first marriage. And so in my second marriage, I went into it knowing that I would have difficulty conceiving and pretty much knowing that, you know, the option would be in vitro fertilization. And had basically sort of written it off. And my husband said, yeah, no. And I was like, what? And it was sort of the thing like, well, I've already been there, done that. Let's just go straight to adoption. But he wanted, it was also part of his process and his journey yes. Of not ready yet to give up uh-huh. his idea of conceiving a child with his own genetic material. Mm-hmm. So yes, I am a case example of that, that it may not always fall along the expected typical gender lines of who wants to do what.
Yeah, I think that, we see that a lot. Mm-hmm. And the importance, and another big decision to be made is, well, we were talking about when I said the escalator, but at what point do you get off the escalator? Yes. At what point do you decide to stop treatment?
Yes.
And how do you process that loss, and which keeps people in treatment sometimes long times after their doctor would really say, mm-hmm. this is, at this point you need to move, but they're not on the, you've got two people in the relationship and they're not on the same page.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so having to deal with then trying to each person cope on their own with mm-hmm. the stress and mm-hmm. the grief and the loss. But yet each of them have to have made peace with it before they can make decisions.
Together as a couple. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. That's tough. Let me pause for a moment to remind you that this show is brought to you in part through the generous support of our partners. These are organizations and clinics that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. We could not be doing what we do without their support, and we thank them. One such partner is Cooper Surgical Fertility and Genomic Solutions. Cooper Surgical Fertility and Genomic Solutions are global leaders in IVF and reproductive genetics. Cooper Genomics offers PGTA, PGTM, PGTSR, and ERP, which is an endometrial receptivity testing, for those who are pursuing IVF. Cooper Genomics genetics tests screen an embryo's genetic health to help your care team select the best embryo for transfer and improve your chances for achieving a successful pregnancy. Now let's talk about some healthy techniques for coping with the stress of infertility. And also, if you, again, could talk about some of the differences you see between men and women. But first of all, let's talk about, we've acknowledged for all the reasons we've talked about how incredibly stressful being infertile is for both men and women, and single women and couples as well. So what are some of the healthy techniques for coping with the stress and the grief and the loss and all that?
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to talk about this in some ways through the frame of the therapy approach that I use in my practice, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, which I won't go too much into because it'll take us down a different path. But essentially, the idea is that the stress that we are encountering is because of, you know, this process is really taking us out of our life, right? And it's getting in our way of being present in the here and moment, and is getting in the way of us sort of being willing to experience all those uncomfortable feelings that we're having associated with it. And so part of my work with clients is to try to remind them that they are still other people. They still have other parts of their identity, other parts of their lives to live. And so in addition to some of the routine standard healthy strategies of making sure you get sleep and proper rest and proper nutrition, but also like remembering that there are other things that you enjoy about life and in re-engaging in those pleasurable activities, giving yourself permission to, you know, because a lot of what happens is, well, when we get pregnant, I will, you know, I'll look for a new job. Or when we get pregnant, I'll replace, you know, that computer that doesn't work anymore. We kind of put those sort of contingencies on getting pregnant. It's like, well, why not allow yourself that now? So I think engaging in pleasurable activities, and I do think some rituals are around this, and not only around, like, you know, some of the more painful events and maybe some of the losses, but also some of the small celebrations, like celebrate everything. Like, okay, we found a new hormone that may work, or okay, this time we got, you know, we grew two more follicles. So I think creating rituals around the process to kind of recognize the lows and the highs. So again, that we can kind of show up and be present in the moment in this is helpful. And I think also knowing when to get help, like knowing when, if you're spending a lot of time sleeping in bed and it's really a lot of disruption in your relationships, when you're not able to focus at work and it's now interfering with your work and productivity. So really just trying to, know when to get help is, I think, also very helpful. And I think the last thing I will say is meaning making, you know, in some of the literature that I've looked at in terms of resilience and what helps, particularly with maybe individuals or couples who never achieved parenthood, that meaning making seemed to be one of those factors that was helpful. So
what do you mean by meaning making?
Yeah, so kind of through this process, thinking about the meaning in life, you know, because again, I think a large part of this story and narrative, especially around like fertility and parenthood, is like what it will mean to have a child or what will it mean to be a parent. And so we might have to question, we have to begin to question that. Because if this is going to be a childless marriage, or if I'm not going to have kids, then what does that mean for my life? What does that mean about what the meaning of my life, right? And so kind of reevaluating our values and priorities. And that's not necessarily saying like accepting, right? And I think that can be a part of it too, but sort of the meaning making for yourself, like what will my life be about if it will not involve having a child?
I really liked what you said about not postponing life. I see so many, we work primarily with women, but I see so many women who are postponing life. Well, once we have kids, we will do this. Or, and sometimes they're postponing for legitimate reasons because they are trying to save money. So we'll take a nice vacation, you know, we're saving money so that we can pay for treatment. So we won't take a vacation. But there's also just little joys that they're not allowing themselves.
Absolutely. And just a couple other things I probably should add too. I think I just want to underscore and make sure increasing social support, I think, is another helpful strategy, and that social support can come in different ways. It might be a support group. It might be some supportive friends. It may be finding a mental health professional, but increasing supports, because individuals in this process can experience a lot of social isolation and can feel very alone and alienated. And I think I just want to also emphasize some self-compassion and being kind to yourself and forgiving for some of those bad, hard days sort of taking it easy on ourselves. So self-compassion, I would also add, is a healthy strategy to deal with the stress of this.
Oftentimes, patients have to make the decision on whether to share their infertility journey. And when you talk about getting social connections, you know, social support for what you're going through, you know, how do we balance the need for feeling like you want to keep it private versus knowing that if you keep it private, people can't reach out and share their stories or offer their support?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And again, I think my own self-disclosure, I experienced that very thing myself. I had a miscarriage and I had not told anyone about the pregnancy, and so didn't have anyone then to tell about the miscarriage. And then, you know, a few years later, when I'm back in this process again, I reevaluated that and said, you know, no, actually, these are the people I want to know, because these are going to be the people I want to talk to. Mm-hmm. And so, and now in my work with clients, that's what I say. I say, I know that there are, it's not everybody in your life who will know what to say or be that person to go to, but think about who are those, you know, two or three persons or individuals in your life that are your go-to that you would want to reach out to support. And are those the ones that you can feel comfortable reaching out to and saying like, I just need you to know this so that when I come to you, you understand what I've been going through. Mm-hmm. Because you're right. It is a balance. But I do think it's really important to evaluate for yourself what your needs are going to be, mm-hmm. and building in that structure so that you have those identified supports on hand and ready in those moments when you need to reach out.
And sharing is not for everybody. I know that and exactly. appreciate that. But I will say that almost everyone says that when they have opened up about their struggle, that there's an outpouring of, they're people they didn't even know about who have struggled. Yes. People in their family, grandparents, or even sometimes their own parents struggled. And they had no idea. And so they felt so less alone once they realized, and so oftentimes they said it was very hopeful because they looked at these people who were eventually able to conceive.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It is such, and that's, I think, back to that question about the guilt and shame. Because of the shame associated, people don't talk about it and they remain isolated and alone. But you're right. Once you open up and you realize others who've had so many similar challenges and difficulties, it's a great place of support and hope.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Let's talk some about the cultural, racial, and religious differences and how people experience infertility stress and cope with the losses and the grief of infertility. Mm-hmm. So just in general, if you want to, let's talk about cultural and racial, and then we'll separate religious since that might have differences. So how, from your standpoint, what do you mm-hmm. see as far as, or are there any differences in how people experience infertility depending on their ethnicity, culture, race, whatever?
Yeah, I would say yes, you know, and I think it actually sort of dovetails to what we were just talking about before in terms of social support and reaching out. I think that in terms of cultural differences and experience of infertility is some of the maybe social stereotypes and ideas about different cultural groups and their ability to conceive and how mm-hmm. fertile members of their communities.
Yeah, the hyper fertile Black woman.
I mean, yes, exactly.
Or the hyper masculine hyper fertile Black male.
Absolutely. It is. Yeah, exactly. So I think you end up countering those social stereotypes, and sometimes even within your own family members who maybe, you know, themselves had no difficulty conceiving and so are kind of, you know, curious about this because it's, you know, and the face of infertility, I think we're getting better about this, but I think the face of infertility is like, you know, a white woman.
A white upper middle class woman. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that those are things, and especially if you get into things like egg donation mm-hmm. or surrogacy, and even, you know, awareness of a desire for those families of color for themselves. So, and I think just some cultural sensitivity mm-hmm. that, you know, in terms of clinics and doctors to some of those issues, I think can impact experiences differentially for different cultural and ethnic groups.
Yeah, I wanted to come in a circle to that at the end. Let's come back to that because I very much want to talk about what clinics can do, because I think that there is a lot they can do to help reduce some of the stress. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about religious differences and how people express it. Now let's come back to and talk about the religious differences and how people experience infertility depending on what religion they are, both how they experience it as well as what their options are, which may or may not be adding increased stress to this experience.
Yes, and I think what influences the experience and also maybe then approaches is the religious beliefs or ideas about conception, childbirth, interventions and what interventions are sanctioned come into play into the decision-making process for individuals of different religious groups. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it is sort of interesting because it can create, for lack of a better word, sort of a cultural, not necessarily a cultural clash, but I think a cultural challenge for individuals who are deeply rooted in their religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. But yet, if there's something about saying, even in some religions, and I've worked with clients who, as part of their deep Christian belief, felt like masturbation was not sanctioned, and so the idea of then sperm, you know, their husband, partner, ejaculating in order to get the sperm for mm-hmm. you know, insemination was something that had to be kind of navigated and worked around for mm-hmm. themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are the things that come up that just require some sensitivity and understanding for the individuals and couples that we're working with.
I think one of the hardest religious difference that we would hear, that we do hear, is when people of whose faith tells them that suffering is God's will, and that this, what they're experiencing, is God's will. And another variation of that would be, well, if it's meant to be, it will happen. And that leaves people feeling, oh, well, for some people that might be actually, you know, quite reassuring and make them feel good. But for others, it leaves them feeling so alone, because if this is God's will, then is it ever going to happen? And if this is God's will, is this an indication that they're not meant to be a parent? And if this is God's will, should they be interfering with God's will by trying to seek treatment for it?
Yes. Yeah. It's very difficult and very challenging. Yet there also can be ways that I think that their religion can be sources of support, you know, through mm-hmm. some of the scripture.
Yes.
And I'm making, I guess, more specifically a Christian reference when I say scripture, but I think there could be prayers or meditations mm-hmm. or scriptures that can be encouraging and supportive and comforting.
To give meaning to your suffering, yes.
Exactly.
Yes. And we know that coping, finding meaning in your challenges through many religions is a tenet of many religions, and from mental health too. We know that those people who are able to find meaning in their suffering often do better. So a religion could certainly do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now for a moment for something really important. Believe it or not, we have been doing this show for 13 years. And if you've been listening for any of that time, you know that we support all types of family building. In fact, we pride ourselves on an unbiased approach. What is right for you is not necessarily right for everyone, and vice versa. We want to educate and support you on your journey. But longtime listeners know that I have a special place in my heart for special needs adoptions. And by special needs, I mean those children who, through no fault of their own, face special challenges in life caused by early life trauma, or prenatal alcohol or drug exposure, or diseases or birth defect. One of the best ways we can help a child heal is to help their parents be better parents when parenting their special need. Creating a Family is doing just that through our Special Needs Parenting Scholarship Fund. This may not be your journey to creating your family, but you can help a vulnerable child by helping us help their parents. Please make a $20 donation to provide one of our 65 plus courses to a parent who is doing the hard work of helping a child heal. Go to creatingafamily.org/scholarship to make your tax deductible donation. Changing a little bit, are there any triggers or specific times of year that you see through your practice are more stressful for infertility patients?
Yes, definitely. I think many of the major holidays can be triggers, particularly Mother's Day, Father's Day, Christmas, mm-hmm. you know, because they are, again, you know, just in terms of the messages that are received in media, it's a reminder again of where you are or are not in this process for yourself. And then the questions that come up, you know, on occasion, mm-hmm. Are, you know, restaurants that are giving out roses to mothers on Mother's mm-hmm. Day.
Churches.
Yeah. Yes. You know, so I think those are difficult. And I think also, you know, your own birthday, you know, marking another year that has passed and another year older that you are. As well, like, again, back to some of those sort of ambiguous losses that we talked about earlier. I think, you know, anniversaries of miscarriages, you know, planned due dates that have passed that were missed, you know, and really remembering like that this was the due date maybe of a child that was lost. You know, we everything is so timed and scheduled and we're all thinking out, you know, 10 months in advance. And I think those dates and times of year, you know, I thought this time last year I would be pregnant. I thought this time last year, you know, I'd have my child. So I think that there are many points and times that come up that are triggers and reminders for individuals.
We did a survey once about what time of year is the most stressful for those suffering with infertility. And two that took me a little by surprise, but after I thought about it, not at all, were Halloween and Easter. And I thought, gosh, it just didn't seem like, and what somebody wrote, and they said, what do you think is on your social media feed for the entire week of Halloween? And of course, what it is adorable little ghosts and goblins and homemade outfits and, you know, and then what's in your feed over Easter? Cute little kids and little boys in suspenders and little girls with bonnets and, you know, Easter bunnies and, you know, baskets and all that. And you, I, you know, you don't think of that.
Right. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. And anytime you have family gatherings, which not necessarily Halloween, but perhaps Easter, then you're faced with, you know, your great aunt, your great aunt Edna, you know, saying, you know, you're not getting any younger or, you know, that type of thing. And you've got to then deal with that. So, yeah, all of that will add further and further difficulty.
Absolutely.
All right. Now I want to shift to what clinics and medical professionals can do to help patients cope with the stress of infertility. The we've talked about all the reasons why it is infertile, but what are some things? Let's start with the negative. That doesn't sound good, does it? But what are some of the things that clinics and nurses and doctors do that make it harder for those struggling with infertility?
You know, and I'm going to talk about this in terms of, I think, what the barriers that providers have that maybe make it more difficult than for the clients. I think that from providers' perspective, they themselves have a lack of time and resources, you know, in terms of time to spend with clients and to talk through and provide that support that they would want. And I think they also probably feel like they don't know what resources are available in the community or what kind of supports should be made available. So, and I think that is felt by clients, you know, in terms of feeling that they're kind of rushed through and that maybe their emotional or psychosocial needs aren't attended to as much as some of the medical physical aspects of infertility, and that the clinic is not attending to those and maybe not providing them information about resources or ways to find social support or helping them get access to social support. So I guess in terms of, you know, answering like, what is it maybe that clinics are not doing, you know, maybe providing information, providing support and resources and time. But I'll like, you know, give the benefit of the doubt. I think that's because they themselves feel a lack of time and resources themselves.
I agree with you. I hear that as well. Something that we hear is, and I think this is probably human nature, but a feeling of being dismissed when there is a failed cycle or a miscarriage. And I suspect it's because the nurse or the doctor doesn't know. They also are feeling the failure and they don't know what to say. But we certainly hear, and this is not across the board because some nurses and some doctors are doing a terrific job, but how can a nurse or a doctor or anyone at the clinic for that matter, how can they convey really bad news in a way that helps the person receiving the bad news?
Yeah, I think this is actually a really important point of discussion and conversation, because I think one thing that from my work with clients and for some of the things I've read is that patients often feel like there's a lack of information. So I think one thing that could really help in the process is in talking about a failed cycle is like also talking about maybe the reasons why and just providing information and sort of destigmatize, I don't know if the stigmatizing is quite the right word, but just sort of de-emphasizing it as a failure per se, but as a like, these are the things that we know about what just happened. And these are things we don't know that we're going to continue to pursue. So I think giving information and kind of increasing access so that clients can feel like they have something to work with and they know like a next step or what the next steps might be or what a plan might be. Mm-hmm. So that can increase their confidence in mm-hmm. their provider and in the doctors and nurses, that they're going to be transparent with them, that they're going to be open with them, that they're going to be honest with them. You know, if they don't know, they'll say, I don't know. But if they do know, they'll tell them and kind of give them a plan. Because I think the lack of information, especially at that time, kind of adds to the stress of mm-hmm. coping with it. And not mm-hmm. knowing, you know, it didn't go right, but we don't exactly know why, can kind of add to the stress.
Unfortunately, sometimes that is the reality. And then honesty, I mean, we don't know why. But as you say, if you have a plan, there are other options we can try that can give hope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. One of the hard parts of the practice of infertility medicine is that often the patients that are the bad information, not so much the miscarriage, but the failed failed pregnancy test with it, that the patient is not pregnant. The logical way to share that information is over the phone, because the person, the test has come in and they're reading the test results, and making a person come back in to receive the bad news doesn't feel like a perfect solution either. So how does the clinic square that hole?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's sort of somewhat unavoidable in a sense, right? Because you want to get the information as soon as possible, and they're great phone calls to make when it's positive news, but maybe less so when it's not. And I think kind of building upon what I just said, I think providing whatever information you can, and I think asking, you know, saying like, you know, I know this is unwelcomed news and not sure what supports you have around you. Would it be helpful to have a list of names or supports or referrals to talk about how you're feeling about this? So I think building a network of referrals and resources. So even if you're doing it over the phone, you can still convey that sense of acknowledging that this is a difficult conversation. And that even if the provider can't do that themselves directly, they can at least connect their client to someone who can. So I mm-hmm. think, you know, in that phone call, being present, listening, demonstrating care, concern, and offering resources and referrals can go a long way. Think of it as sort of a caring connection that you're making to this person, and you're demonstrating kind of, you know, that genuine care and concern, and offering what resources and support you may have for them.
What about having a part of the protocol beforehand be to find out how the patient wants to receive bad news? Is that something that some clinics do? In other words, do they want to know at night? Do they want to know in the morning? Do they want to be called at work? Do they not want to be called at work? Mm-hmm. Do they want to be called when their partner is around? Things, that type of information, do you see clinics doing much of that?
I don't see as much of it as I think that would be helpful, but I definitely am seeing more of that. And I'm seeing clinics sort of ask those kinds of questions. Like I said, like, is it, you know, do you want me to leave a voicemail? Do you want me to call? Is there a certain time to call? What number should I call? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think with some of the clients that I've worked with, because they've been prepared with those questions and they get a call, they're like, okay, I'm waiting till I get home to listen to this voicemail message, or, you know, so mm-hmm. they make their own sort of contingency plans around that. But I do think those are strategies that clinics can implement just to help with that mm-hmm. process for clients receiving the information.
So what are some things that clinics or nurses or doctors can do to help address the additional stress that certain races and cultures feel through the process?
Mm-hmm. Again, I think, you know, I don't want to say sort of broadly like cultural sensitivity training, because I think that becomes like very, very broad. But I think in the same way that you just asked about like notification, I think asking is part of a standard intake process. You know, to what extent is there's a role of religion important to you as part of your coping process? What are things about your culture that's important for me to know as we go into this process? What will be helpful for you? And that's, you know, consistent with your ideas and belief systems. Mm-hmm. So I think those questions up front, I think, could go a long way in at least creating the dialogue. And I think if there's anything I would encourage nurses and doctors to do, is not feel like they have to know those answers in advance, and they can have this sort of curious naivete about it, which actually is extremely helpful. It's like, you know, I don't know much about this. Can you tell me?
Mm-hmm.
So that I can make sure I'm prepared to give you the best care possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have one area that with that, and this is less in the treatment, but I have heard on a number of occasions, patients with leftover embryos went after they finished their treatment, which is a slightly different time frame, obviously, mm-hmm. but it's still part of infertility and it's still stressful. And some of the families, our patients, are really struggling with what to do with their remaining embryos. And a total lack of understanding from some in the medical profession as to why this would be a difficult decision. Again, not across the board. Hashtag not all. But for some, it's just, and I have had conversations with doctors who just don't get it. It's like they can't imagine why anybody, we just throw them out, you know, whatever. It's no big deal, you know, that type of thing. And just, and also with, we have heard of people who believe that they want to prevent how many embryos are created because they know that given their belief, their religious beliefs, that it will be a very difficult decision. And again, doctors and nurses not being respectful, because obviously you would be becoming a little less so because of the ability to freeze eggs now, but it's still easier to freeze embryos. So from their standpoint, if your goal is to have a child, then creating as many embryos as you can, it will take you towards that goal, and not appreciating that for the patient herself or himself, that adds further stress that they can see coming down the line, and not appreciating that.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we actually do hear that. We hear that more often. We hear it quite a bit, actually. Let's just put it that way. In the context of, it's the context of when life begins and the personhood of embryos. Yeah. And just, and for doctors often not appreciating that. One thing I would say that whether or not this from a race, culture, and ethnicity standpoint, whether or not, as well as the LGBTQ plus issues, whether or not this really reduces stress, but it certainly would make the patient feel more welcomed. If pictures on the website, pictures on the wall in the clinic were inclusive of their race or their sexual orientation, or if there was more diversity, or whether they were single or married, that I don't know that, I'm not sure it would reduce stress, but it would certainly not add stress.
No, absolutely. And you're right. It would create a welcoming environment, and it's sort of these sort of it sends signals, right, about mm-hmm. welcoming and openness and attentive to cultural diversity on part of the clinic and agency. So I agree with you. I think those are also important ways that can be, you know, I was going to say important, and maybe in some ways somewhat subtle, but just sort of sending a message and creating that sense of inclusivity.
Yeah. Yes. And I liked how you said it before about a feeling of welcome, that you are welcomed here, and that this is a community that you belong to, and that we have resources, and we help people who look like you or whose family mm-hmm. looks like your family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I think that, again, I'm not 100% sure how it addresses the stress, but if you felt more welcome in the place, then you feel less alone when you are stressed because the treatment did not work.
Right. Yeah. And to that extent too, I think any attempts to kind of develop a culturally diverse staff as well.
Mm-hmm.
For
yes. Yeah, good point. It's not just in pictures. Yeah, let's get past the pictures. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Now, I also, the last question I want to talk about is how to find a therapist that understands infertility. Because infertility, for all the reasons we've talked about, is not the same as other losses, is not the same as other stresses. So if once you've, like you said earlier, one of the coping mechanisms is reaching out for help from a trained professional. So how do you find a person who understands the losses and grief and stress of infertility?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because you're absolutely right that in terms of identifying a clinician well-versed in this topic is, I think, can be helpful in reducing the stress. It's part of the reason why, as a psychologist, the latter part of my career, I focused on this to be available for individuals going through.
Yeah. Well, and you particularly are in a good, not a good position, but having actually had the lived experience, is extra helpful, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I often will say to clients is that, you know, you're not going to have to spend the first 20 minutes of your session explaining all of these acronyms and medical procedures that you're
yes.
going through. I know them already.
It's yeah.
Okay. It's okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So I would say then if you're, you know, to look for a mental health provider or find a therapist, I would go to those professional organizations and groups that specialize in infertility. So Resolve is a great place to go. You can look for providers, you can find support groups, you can find professionally led support groups on the Resolve website. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine also is a great place to go, because, you know, through those contacts, then as providers, we have access to resources and tools and trainings mm-hmm. related. And we're also staying current in the field as well, in terms of what medical procedures are evolving and what are recommendations from the field mm-hmm. as well. So I think those, in terms of organizations, those two come to mind, you know, and there are other, you know, sometimes I think I do feel like clinics are getting better at building supportive networks.
I think they are as well.
Yeah. You know, and there are other websites, many of them, you know, started by individuals who've gone through the process themselves, and they will list referrals and places that are recommended. So again, sort of through that network of support of individuals in the process is a good way to find someone who knows this feel, knows this experience. And it doesn't have to be a lived experience, but just at least someone who can sort of navigate it and understand it. Mm-hmm. So that, again, like I said, so that in your first session, you don't have to spend half of your time explaining, you know, the terminology.
Exactly. The American Society of, first of all, let me say that many, many clinics now either have somebody that they're affiliated with or know somebody. Now, sometimes people are not, their clinic is not nearby for them. So I think that may be a little bit, but most clinics, I think now really can give you advice on somebody who is nearby, at least nearby to mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important, and we've made huge strides, I think, on that. Also, you had mentioned the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, ASRM. They list members that are mental health professionals, and they list them by state. So, and these are therapists who belong to ASRM, and as Dr. Wood said, are there and are they're keeping up. And obviously, they're not going to belong to a professional organization that is dedicated to infertility if they don't specialize in there as well. So that's another a really good source of finding mm-hmm. a mental health mm-hmm. professional as well. And I imagine some of the state mental health associations might list their members and list the topics their members specialize in. So that would be another source.
Yeah, absolutely. I as the current president, I would be remiss to not mention that as well, that state psychological associations or state mental health associations
right.
In general have provider referral sources and that they are You know, and again, getting better about being able to identify areas of specialization.
Yes.
I think I do encourage anyone who's looking for a therapist to, you know, take the time to interview. You know, we are not all created equally. And so I think finding someone who, spending a 15-minute phone call in advance to get some understanding of their history and background and familiarity with this is okay. And you can do that, and you can advocate for yourself in this way as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most therapists will do a phone consult. We'll talk with you by the phone to determine for a short period of time so that they can be interviewed so that you can see whether it's a good fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tanya Wood, for talking with us on this interview today about the coping with the stress of infertility. Let me remind people that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. Thank you for joining us today, and I will see you next week. And before you go, don't forget to make your $20 donation to the Creating a Family Special Needs Parenting Scholarship Fund at creatingafamily.org/scholarship. Thank you so much.